Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com. Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about 2 fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today, and thank you.
Good afternoon, greetings and salutations. This is Aaron Foster bringing Cutting the Curd to you, our weekly-ish show about cheese and accompaniments and cheese-related, cheese-adjacent things and delectables and delights. I am here with my guest, Jeff Russell. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how's it going?
That's good. Jeff is coming to us, and we're going to talk about cider this week. And you might be thinking, wait, this is a cheese show. But we often discuss pairings and accoutrements and things that make cheese just that much better. And cider is one of those things. Cider is definitely, I think, one of the better, if not the best, of those things. Ooh, that sounded a little Trumpian. I didn't mean it to.
No absolutes. Let's not be Sith here.
Well, he's a teetotaler, so we don't trust him. Jeff comes to us with a great deal of experience in cider and in wine. Right now, he is the sales director for Eden Cider, which you may have seen these adorable orange cans with the apple on them around town or perhaps in bottle. But before that, he was with MFW Wine Company and also the Terroir Group as well, I believe. Yeah. So he has a deep and abiding love of the apple and its associated ferment. So we're going to talk to Jeff today a little bit about cider and just sort of what the state of the nation of cider is and where it's at in terms of its sort of renaissance. I think he'll jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but cider is one of these things that was extremely important in America for a long time and then kind of went away.
Extremely important, one of them. Main reasons people got their homesteads, helped people with clean water as we moved westward. And
so you're saying we ended up drinking cider instead of...
It's actually the reason for the teetotaler movement. Carrie Nation was running in with axes, busting up giant barrels of cider. A lot of the time, everyone's thinking it's bourbon.
Yeah, that's what I mean. In the movies, it's bourbon.
Cider.
Well, who knew? All right. So I think what we're going to do today is just do a little bit of talking about where cider is at the moment, talk about kind of the cider movement. There's a lot of cider fanatics out there. Maybe just define the term, I think, and then go from there. And then we'll talk about pairing and how it fits in with cheese. I feel like cider has a great deal of, let's say, like parallel lives, parallel trajectories with cheese. And I think it would be fun to kind of highlight some of those. And then we might break into a couple bottles or cans and eat some cheese and cider. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Awesome. All right. So why don't you tell us bring us up till now. You give us a little bit of that tidbit of history, but like, I feel like maybe past 10 years ago, I wasn't really hearing much about cider other than like woodchuck. So how do we get to now?
So a lot of different things happened. Two main cideries that I think really can be credited for where we are now and how we got to this point are going to be Farnham Hill. Steve Wood did some amazing things. He's the one who kind of reclaimed.
They're in New Hampshire?
Lebanon, New Hampshire.
Great.
And Steve was one of the first people to really start growing proper cider apples again in the U.S.
So I might jump in and ask a couple of questions.
Please keep me on
track.
Maybe
some of these are dumb questions, but so you said a cider apple. Are those not apples?
They're all apples.
Okay.
But we have what we call dessert fruit, and then we have cider fruit. Sharps, bitter sharps, sweets, bitter sweets. And when it comes to cider fruit, it really has to do with tannin level and acidity.
Okay.
And their measurements. And
so dessert apples, like the apple that the apple you have teacher.
Red Delicious. Those beautiful apples that you see on teacher's desk. Exactly.
Some of them, which kind of tastes like garbage or?
Some of them, like, I don't think you should eat Red Delicious. I think they're pretty, but there's no reason to eat them.
Fair enough.
But with the teetotaler movement and prohibition, I know prohibition is the reason for a lot of problems in this country. Originally, America had more apples at one point than anywhere else in the world. Apple trees are extremely heterozygous. So when you think of an apple, I know, big word.
I got a tickle.
I'm studying for my SATs. but when you cut open an apple, you know, everyone had this in kindergarten. When you cut it open, you saw those beautiful seeds right inside in the shape of a star. Each of those is different genetic material. So if you let a tree breed on its own, it's going to create an entirely different apple. The only way to actually get the same apple is to graft your genetic material. So take cuttings from another apple tree because you found an apple you like and put it back onto the whatever stock of your choice.
Okay.
Whatever tree you have. This can be done multiple times. I mean, it's not a viable thing to do.
So I've heard of these things where they have like trees with 50 different fruits on them. That's like a grafting situation.
If you ever go out to Art and Science Ciders in Oregon, Kim and Dan have just such a tree right in their front yard.
Very cool.
So it is possible. But basically, because with people homesteading and moving out, Johnny Appleseed was a real person. We don't need to go into that whole thing.
Okay.
But for the government to deed you your homestead, you needed 50 fruit trees on the land. So what Johnny Appleseed was doing was going around and planting fruit trees and then taking payment for getting the land ready for the government to give it to you. And he was planting apples because you had the ability to turn that into a low alcohol cider. It was safe to drink. It was part of everyday life. You'd give it to field hands if anyone joined you.
So it was something that had, there was a market already there.
Was a big market. Cider came to America and it just started exploding. The apples weren't native to America, but once they got here, they took right to it and started becoming America's
pretty food. Quickly, we had more apples than anyone else.
Exactly. Literally thousands of varietals, and you can still see that. Great book to read. Andy Brennan from Aaron Burr Cider just came out with a book that goes pretty deeply into this. If anyone's interested in a deep dive.
But we'll do a 201 next time.
Because people were mainly growing cider apples and had some fruit that wasn't really what we have now. People weren't just grafting on a lot of
Granny Smiths,
these.
No
exactly. They were around. Red Delicious was probably like late 1800s. Hmm. But a lot of people were still growing cider fruit. With the passage of the Volstead Act, which is actually what classified alcoholic beverages and what you could create. It's the actual law that outlawed everything, not the amendment.
Gotcha.
People went in and actually ripped out trees, burned down trees, because they thought that the only use for these apples was to make cider. So we got stuck with...
And the owners did that, or like the T-men came in, both?
Yeah, men in black suits came in. Just kind of ripped it out because government didn't trust us. People were left with a couple of these varietals that no one was really buying. We ended up with the same five apple varietals continually grown, these kind of abused orchards that we have today. Just because no one wanted us making cider.
And so most after, or sort of beginning and during Prohibition, a lot of these apple varieties went away because they were no longer useful and were actually could only be made into something illegal.
Yeah, they'd be what government. We, like cider apples, some of them we classify as spitters. You're just going to take spitters, a bite. Nice. They're coming right out.
Great.
So they weren't useful. It's actually why the government came out with the whole an apple a day keeps the doctor away campaign. It's government propaganda to help people who now are at a loss or not selling alcoholic cider anymore to sell some of this fruit that wasn't being sold.
Who knew
before.
There was such an insidious backstory to that?
Yeah.
So Prohibition happens. People, you know, start bootlegging and doing all that. Prohibition goes away, but because those
we're
apples...
We're stuck with all these just kind of basic apples.
Dessert apples.
So, you know, Steve Wood helped bring back a lot of traditional English varietals, started grafting true cider apples. And then he, along with West County Ciders, which has been around since, I believe, the late 80s as well.
And they're in...
Massachusetts. Up near, kind of near Deerfield, where Northampton-ish
like Western
area.
Mass area.
Yeah, where they do cider days every year.
Berkshires.
Great cider festival.
That's like a big, like, cider Woodstock.
Pretty much. It's the best cider festival in America.
All right. Is it open to the public?
It is.
Okay, cool. Mark your calendars, kids. And so why is it that only in the last 10 years
it takes about 8 years for trees to develop. You start getting fruit. Steve sells some of his juice to a lot of these cider makers that are popping up now. So they have solid juice to actually create cider with. I hate saying this, but I really do think the gluten-free movement is a major reason
because cider has no gluten, right? Yeah. Are there ciders that have gluten or they're just,
I mean, unless you're adding something to it. They're going to be gluten-free, but, I think that really is the push that made like major breweries start to pay attention and move into cider where they're like, oh, we need an option for the gluten-free people.
And you feel like cider is like booming right now, or is it growing kind of like is there enough apples?
It's a mixed bag. There are not enough apples. But you know, there are, I want to say about 910, probably a few more as of now. But the last, I saw about 910 cider licenses in America. 634 of those are probably just cideries, not like your brewery that has a cider cider addition,
like
things like that.
Like primary cider makers.
And then probably like 3% of that are going to be like traditional cideries, like Eden or Farnham Hill.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. I noticed in doing research for this show that a lot of the states that are producing some of the what you're calling traditional cider. Let's define that term actually.
Sure.
So yeah.
So this is a big thing. It's hard to come up with like a nomenclature. The United States Association of Cider Makers now has Heritage Cider, which we're trying to kind of change the name of right now.
Because it has racist overtones?
That's exactly why.
Okay, cool. great.
And then modern ciders. So modern ciders are all your like fruit added, kind of a lot of them are quicker brewed. Then what we make, more traditional ciders, would be only apples. They're going to be made at or around harvest, so you're not sweating or holding your apples in cold storage as they develop for very long. You're not like keeping apples there and making your cider all year.
Gotcha.
You're only making your cider once a year.
So it's like a vintage like grapes.
Yeah. You're treating it a lot like wine. The best example, think of it like making wine as opposed to making a beer.
And cider is basically apple wine. Yeah, I feel like in our brains, we lump it together with beer more than we do with wine for some reason. I wonder if that's, is that like alcohol level or just how it's
some
marketed?
Of it, depends on packaging. Like cider is a really weird thing right now because language is really hard to come by because it's a thing that was traditional, then went away, and now is coming back. So there's a nomenclature that still needs to be developed, but people have some words for it.
Gotcha.
So like the word dry means nothing on a label.
Like it has no legal
meaning.
Customary definition.
No, New York State just came out with a, and we were part of helping to create this, Eleanor, my boss was, Creating the cider scale. It's actually right here on one of the cans.
We have a can here, actually. So that's a good cue. I'm going to open it. We're going to taste some with a little cheese while we, as we... Oh, that was good.
That's a beautiful sound.
Yeah, that was really good. I'm going to save that for later. The sound, not the cider. I'm drinking that right now.
But we use the German Riesling scale, essentially. It's a combination of acidity as well as sugar to balance it and give you an actual scale to look at. But
okay.
There's no legal...
Well, and the German Riesling scale is known for being extremely transparent to the average customer.
And that's what we want. That's what we want more people to adopt. But people who are not using this can use whatever they want. It could be any residual level and still call it dry. There's no law for it.
So getting back to this, I have noticed of late that what seemed to be really significant cider-producing states, and I know this just because we carry cider at my shop, states like Vermont... California, Oregon, and New York State all seem to be pretty at the forefront of like traditional cider production. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, definitely.
So it's interesting. Those are states that I think are at the forefront also of artisan cheese production. I have some thoughts on this. Do you think there's any connection there as to why?
100%. I think... you have these farms that are especially early on that you're trying to create a system that you're living off this all year. It's what now we try to do with we're using holistic practices, or if you're in a winery, biodynamic.
Okay.
I compare them. I like to say holistic, if we're both magic, people who practice holistic orchards are like druids, and biodynamics is kind of like straight up wizards. We're both a little bit of magic, just a little different.
Okay.
And creating our own little...
Where are the mages in this?
The mages would be... Oh, let's call them organic. actually, they're using a lot of copper. Let's call them the alchemists.
listeners are dropping off like flies right now.
Sorry.
I blame myself. So you think that it has to do with the fact that these are agricultural states and
you're we're gonna talk about it when we get to just straight pairing practices, but I always like to go with, you know, if it grows together, it goes together.
Right.
And when you have these cows and you have your apples growing, like you want to use your cows and chickens and everything else to kind of fertilize your orchards, bring them back. You have a healthy diet because you have healthy lawns, healthy manure. Things going in. You might be making some cheese for your neighbors as well as making cider traditionally. So I feel a lot of things could have developed in kind. You also, we have a great relationship with a few different cheese agers, offenors.
Sure, like the sellers at Jasper Hill,
exactly.
Aging or...
And we wash with cider, so it's a great way when you're making cheese, you know, realizing that you can keep these cheeses clean as you age them.
So these are things, it's interesting, right? Because these are things that traditionally in Europe, I mean, we often talk about this, how America has reinterpreted and remixed traditional European foodways. And these are things that would have traditionally gone together in England or in France or other places where they have rich, or Spain, where there are these rich cider traditions. And you would have had, it's just nice to know that somehow that thread hasn't been dropped since, you know, that prohibition didn't destroy it, and somehow there's still a connection there.
Yeah.
Cool. You just sort of mentioned pairing. I think we should talk a little bit about that, but first I did want to say, like, do you feel like if there's one takeaway in terms of like what you want people to know about cider, what you want people to know about, let's say, buying cider or the cider movement or where it's at right now, like, what do you think that would be?
I want just people to start asking questions.
Okay.
I think about their cider. I think you should ask, when you first get a cider, where did the apples come from?
Meaning, you know, like, did they come from the U.S.? Did they come from the farm that they were made on? Like,
did this orchardist get his own apples? Is he buying juice? Is he buying apples? And there's not a wrong answer to this, because you can always get a great source. We have our own orchards, but we also have about 5 other growing partners that we deal very closely with.
And then, is buying juice like a, is that not cool or is cool? No, or it depends?
It completely depends. These are all questions just to, like, you know, to take the next step deeper into what you're drinking. There can be, like, because you could be buying Mott's apple juice, or you could be buying something from Steve. at Farnham Hill. So there's,
and then you can make cider for both.
Yeah, I'm not going to make
judgment calls,
absolute judgments on any of this. They're just questions you should ask.
And like when, okay, so it's ask questions, try to learn a little bit more.
See, like we try to label all of our apple varietals on the can. Like what apples are they? If it's sweet, why is it sweet? Mm. Did they add sugar to this? Back sweetened with fresh juice? In our case, we're always using our ice cider. There's not a bag of sugar anywhere on the property. Did they halt fermentation? And is it the natural sugars? Or did they just dump a bunch of cane sugar in there?
Interesting. All right. So I definitely want to get to the sweetness question. Why don't we take a quick break to hear from some of our great supporters and sponsors, and then we'll come back and spend some more time with Jeff Russell talking about cider, and then definitely cheese. We will get to cheese.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk, cooked, pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
All right, we're back. Thank you very much for sticking with us. Again, this is Cutting the Curd, your semi-weekly-ish kinda show on the Heritage Radio Network about all things cheese and all things sort of cheese adjacent and cheese friendly. And there's nothing that goes better with cheese than cider. And I say that because I have a cider guest in the room today. He's Jeff Russell from Eden Cider. Thanks for being with us again, Jeff.
Thank you.
All right. So we haven't talked a whole lot about cheese, and I feel like I owe it to my listeners to bring us back into that that neck of the woods. So at my shop, we sell cheese, we sell cider. I'm always a big evangelist of cider because I think it goes really well with cheese. And you mentioned earlier this sort of lesson, if it grows together, it goes together, or rule of thumb, handy jingle, whatever you want to call it. And I've often kind of tossed that out at customers as well. And we try to carry ciders and cheeses from the same place. And I think it's true that they do talk nicely to each other. But I feel like I get a lot of questions about bubbles versus no bubbles. I feel like my customers still don't really understand still cider. So why don't we jump in and talk about what makes a good pairing with cheese. And I should say right now we're snacking on Neal's Yard Dairy Montgomery's Cheddar, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal Somerset West Country cheddar, raw milk, matured by Neal's Yard Dairy. Happy 40th anniversary, Neal's Yard. We're thinking of you. And we are drinking the Eden Heritage Cider. And you said the varietals are actually on the can. Are they on the can? Where are they?
They're right above here.
Oh, there we go. Dabinette, Macintosh, Empire, Spartan, and Esipus Spitzenberg.
And they change every year.
Sounds like my Jewish uncle.
Did he come and he comes in, makes you gefilte fish?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Espen Spitzenberg is actually one of my favorite apples. It's great in a blend.
Is it named after a person?
The Espen Spitzenberg, I can't remember the history. I think it's the place. Or no, Espen Spitzenberg is the person and the place, I'm pretty sure, of where they found it growing, but I'm not 100% sure. Need to check Rowan Jacobson's book.
No problem, yeah.
Sorry, Matt. It's been a long weekend.
I spent
all Thursday with drag queens on Cherry Grove, and my brain's still fried.
All right.
But
then you did it right, I think.
I did it very much right. But just to note, too, with all those apples, they change every year, and we do a little pumice ferment with that, so it has a little more tannin.
Pumice, that means...
So we take
skin contact cider?
It's a ferment with skin contact from the Debonet. Last year it was Kingston Black Apples.
So if the wine kids out there are after like a orange wine, is that it's like the analogy?
It's more like a batonnage, like keeping the lees kind of stirred. Like it adds a little bit more to it and a little more tannin.
All right.
It's not quite an orange wine, but still a little more full.
Okay.
And gets some of the qualities of the Debonet through it.
Cool. Super cool. Tell me about bubbles versus still, because I know most wine we drink is still wine, unless you're balling. But I feel like in cider, generally speaking, I would say a lot of the ciders that are available to me to purchase, and then a lot of the ciders people come in and ask for, are going to be sparkling.
Yeah, it's very hard to sell still cider, no matter how good it is. Haven't moved behind it yet. But I love it. Properly made still ciders, I think, are like a great wine. I'm going to say Eve's Cidery from upstate New York. Their Albee Hill is one of the better still ciders on the market.
I like that cider a lot.
The Cinderella Slipper, which we've made twice in 14 and 16. There's 16 still on the market, is another one of my favorites. And whenever Steve Wood at Farnham Hill does his Kingston Black, it's...
Oh, yeah. I've had that one, too. That's great.
It's lovely.
But so tell me, is it just a matter of choice on the part of the cider maker?
Because there are a lot of ways. So it's another question I like people to ask, and this will go into the pairing, but how did it get bubbly? So a lot of ciders on the market...
How do it work?
...go into a bright tank, and they force carbonate. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's how we do our can. As long as the juice is good, you're not going to get these super fine bubbles, but you get something great. We just think this juice works better in a can with some bubbles. It's going to play better. I think it's pairing well with the cheddar. It kind of cuts through a little bit.
Yeah, you get the scrubbing bubbles effect.
Yep. We do a lot of Method Champenois stuff. Our mainline Brut Natur and our Etrusac are both Method Champenois. Kite and String up in the Finger Lakes does some excellent Method Champenois stuff. So all exactly like champagne. We let our stuff sit for 9 months on the lees, and it gets super fine bubbles, really pretty, and that you can pair... in my opinion, with any really kind of creamy cheeses, anything a little bit rich and funky a lot of the time.
So that it helps kind of clear off the fat all that from the fat, palate.
Yeah.
What would you conversely pair with something, like a dry... Are dry ciders generally sweet? Are they tannic?
They can generally... They're still and dry. They've gone through complete fermentation. There's no residual left. They can be nice with a Manchego, something like that, like a little bit lighter, sharp and hard, because they have a lot of acidity most of the time. So that acid helps. Think of pairing in terms of our Cinderella Slipper, it drinks a lot like Crooner or Cacerato for the newer one coming out. So I like to think high acid white wine is the same way I would pair with cheese.
So you could pair a white Burgundy, or you could pair, or even... Or
actually, there are some, the Albee Hill a lot of the time. It's not as dense, but you can do a Burgundian style pairing with that.
Gotcha. I'm thinking of, certain Rieslings remind me a lot. But then you start to get into this conversation of residual sweetness and acidity.
I mean, I worked for Paul Greco for 4 years. So.
Yes, the Mr. Riesling himself.
Mr. Riesling himself.
I think that's a good segue into a discussion about sweetness and cider. And I think this is as a vendor of cider, the biggest question I get is it sweet?
Yeah.
It used to be is it sweet? 'Cause I want it sweet. And now it's is it sweet? 'Cause I definitely don't want it sweet.
So that's probably the toughest thing about cider right now. Obviously, I pick easy things to sell, going from Riesling into cider. I'm clearly championing a cause here.
Wait, is that cause RS?
It's RS. Okay. I am
RS being residual sugar here.
So in something like we're drinking right now, this can has about 12 grams per liter residual sugar.
Okay.
So if we're talking about like Riesling,
yeah.
9 grams and below is Trocken or dry.
Okay.
So we're just off dry here. We're going to be in like the Halbtrocken level with this can. Finer.
All right. And that's different from Spot Lazy.
That's way higher up.
TBA, blah, blah, blah.
We're almost four times once we're in there. And with sugar in cider, like we were talking about before, there's dry really means nothing once you see something like the scale on the side.
Because this doesn't taste sweet to me. It almost tastes salty. It feels like it has tension, maybe. I feel like I'm still learning these wine words and cider words, but like I feel like wine people talk to me about tension a lot, and I try to identify it.
I think those are actually great descriptors. I also think this is a little bit honeyed in the back in terms of the sweetness. And that comes from where we get our sugars, hence the question, you know, if it's sweet, why is it sweet? So what we're doing with this is...
Is that to say that all sugars aren't made equal?
They are not made equal. It's the difference between like what Blue Nun was in the 70s, if anyone remembers the Yellowtail of Riesling.
Wow, all right.
You can have a bottle now, it's not that bad.
That's right, it'll be dry in about 100 years.
Or like, you know, a sweet wine from something like Trader Joe's would make, where they're throwing in sugar, they're chaptalizing, they're going to add more sugar and just stabilize it to keep it from re-fermenting. Mm. That's just cane sugar, and it's very different from what you're going to get in natural apple sugars.
I'm reminded of beer here where certain beers, even though they're fermented quite dryly, they have ingredients that make you think that they have a hint of sweetness. So like a stout with vanilla beans, your brain always associates vanilla beans with sugar and sweetness and ice cream and things. Mm-hmm. And so your brain tastes the stout as being sweet, even though it's as dry or drier than the IPAs that you're drinking.
Yeah, and it's a question of, in the general public, a lot of what I get, people, I think, I don't think it's so confused. I just don't think they have the vocabulary because they're not drinking a lot. Is the difference between fruit forward and sweet? Like you can get fruit forward would be something like Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. You get all of these bright tropical notes a lot of the time, but it can be bone dry. There's no residual sugar, and people will think that's sweet. It's just more of a fruit forward thing.
Huh. So it's just those other flavors.
They just get in their brain.
The signifiers.
Yeah. As opposed to something like, and there are sugars in ciders, specifically pear cider, sorbitol, can't be fermented. And it's a secondary sugar.
Ingredient so or that's a natural constituent
that's
of.
That's why it's in pear cider. It's one of those things that it'll come off as sweet, even though you've fermented out everything you can. Most pears will still have a little bit of this like hint of sweetness on the back.
Huh. And that's because pears sorbitol. Just have natural sorbitol in them? Yep. I feel like sorbitol is one of those things I see in toothpaste. It's like a natural, like a
that little back sweetener
sugar-esque thing. Interesting. And so how do you feel like the sweetness question plays into pairing and cheese?
I think with if you're like us and you're using ice cider, it gives it that honeyed back. So we make an ice cider for pretty much anything we back sweeten. It's just blending our ice cider. For even the can, we make an ice cider that goes to 6.2%, put it outside to just naturally halt the fermentation, and blend
like
that back
in. Actually outside in the wintertime.
Yeah, all of ours is what we call cold crashed. So once it gets to the alcohol percentage we want, we throw it back outside. It's normally like negative 15 degrees. It's done.
Oh, crazy.
Right, well, by the time we're done fermenting, a little warmer than that, but on average, it'll get down to negative 15. And
so ice cider, like, our it's area not a... It's not a euphemism.
It's a little ice cider. We naturally freeze the juice, let it thaw, and the first 20% we take and ferment. It's a natural freeze and thaw, just that's in cool. large totes next to the barn. So that gives it a very specific like richness in the back, which I think pairs well with a lot of like funkier cheeses. I think it's a good. I like the opposite pairing a lot.
Well, I love ice ciders and particularly sweeter ciders with say blue cheeses or. Saltier cheeses.
Exactly. I love it with blue cheese. Yeah. I think it's fantastic. And even French ciders that aren't as sweet, like they're all natural sugars from a process called keeving. You basically put it into a bottle for a secondary fermentation, like a champagne. But because during fermentation of these French ciders, you leave them on the with everything after crush, absorbs some extra pectin, things like that. You put it into barrel for the primary. If you're familiar with like a sherry fermentation, it gets the floor.
Right.
In French cider, it gets the grossest floor of all time. It's a layer of pectin up top.
Fermentation
will start going. It's very gross.
Like,
but makes delicious.
Jelly.
It's a jelly top, and it acts as a natural filter. Brings out a lot of the nutrients too. It'll drop. In French, it's called defecation. In British, it's the flying. In English, it's the flying lees. It's the one time the French are more eloquent than the British. Yeah, it's in terms of booze.
It makes it sound so fancy and highfalutin when you say it like that.
I know. I'm just a fancy guy.
Yeah. Well, that's why you're here.
So you get that, and there's not enough nutrients to finish fermentation, so you get this naturally sweet, low-alcohol cider in terms of French style a lot of the time. So, and that pairs perfectly with like blue cheeses, things like that. Like natural sugars and like a little bit of tannin, I think, are perfect with cheeses.
Well, I'm reminded of things like Chateau de Kiem, Sauternes, these, or you know, if you like the Hungarian sweet wines, the Tokais, where they have a long-standing history of being paired with these kinds of things, and so it's an easy step for the end consumer to be like, oh well. This works, so let me find a cider that at least is in the same ballpark.
Yeah, and then for me, like, I'm from Long Island, so this is hardcore white trash inside of me, but every once in a while, I'll have some of our ice cider, or other people's ice ciders. Again, Eve's, I'm going to quote as another person making something fantastic, because I don't want to just plug our stuff, with just a really good cheddar. It gets you to that point of, like, diner apple pie.
Oh,
with
yeah.
almost like a slice of American cheese melted on top.
I really like Cabot Seriously Sharp myself. It's with the Hunter's Plaid.
Oh,
I'm into it.
Oh, yeah.
Which, just sort of
on top of that bake.
Secret, it's if you have ever seen the Cabot Racer's Edge, it is the same cheese, but just branded for the NASCAR market.
Huh. Did not know that.
White plaid instead. White checkered. So, you know.
Can I call the checkered flag white plaid from now on?
Yes, that's basically what it is. That's good. I like that. So I guess what I want to kind of finish up with and leave with is some tips and tricks that, our listeners can take to any old picnic or any old shop, whatever it is. It sounds like if it grows together, it goes together. So if somebody is buying some Spanish cheeses, they might want to look for some Spanish ciders. There's great ones from the Asturias or the Basque region.
Yeah.
If someone's buying some English cheeses or even English inspired cheeses, so we're talking cheddars, territorials, there are a lot of British ciders that are excellent. Not a ton of which are coming into the States, but there are also American ciders that are.
I would honestly say, like, a rule of thumb for that, a lot of like traditional method, things that are close to champagne. I hate to say it's in the packaging, but like things in 375s or 750s are normally going to be dry just because it's hard to decode
then
labels,
like,
right now.
A can or 12 ounce bottle.
Yeah, you're going to be guaranteed pretty much a natural fermentation.
Actually, that's a great tip. All right. Yeah. So, if you didn't catch that, look for ciders. You know, if you're looking to get a really good cider, your luck is better in 375s or 750s.
Just in terms of, you know, American ciders and British, like, you're probably going to have a secondary fermentation in bottle that way.
Oh,
or
okay.
Something that's going to be on the drier side. It doesn't always work, but it's a good rule of thumb.
Crappy juice in an expensive bottle is what you're
saying. Most of the time.
Yeah.
Look for, like, you know, Burgundy bottle. Can be a crown cap or a...
Or
actual
cage.
Cork and cage, but yeah. You know, 375s and 750s are a good way to kind of do it.
Best way
is go to your shop or go to a really good shop. Brooklyn Wine Exchange is a great spot. Vine Wine in Williamsburg.
Yep, they have a great great cider selection. Henry's in Bushwick has an excellent selection. Dandelion Wine
is fantastic.
And then Astor Wines, of course, the big one in the city, has a wide variety of cider.
Somewhere you know where you're going, people know you, know your palate, and they're going to be able to answer questions.
And I think we should also encourage people to experiment.
Yeah, if you want to go, just go out. If you want to do tastes of any, or not taste, but, you know, be able to get some small pours of everything, Owl Farm.
Start
to get to know what you want.
Cool, yeah. If you're in Brooklyn, Owl Farm has a wonderful selection of ciders on both bottle, and they always usually have at least a line or two.
Or Beer Street and Graham Avenue always has something good.
Yeah, Beer Street, excellent, and in Williamsburg as well. Cool. So I think that's going to wrap it up for us. If there's anything you want to add, what are you most excited about on the horizon for cider, for cheese? Anything?
Cider-wise,
new producers, new...
Yeah, my favorites right now are probably South Hill is really good. Haken from Colorado.
Oh, I don't know them.
Aaron, oh, I'll bring you some bottles.
Excellent.
It's very good. They're hard to find because they're mainly sold
Friends
in Colorado.
In high places, dear listener.
Art and Science out in Oregon. And for people in New York, they don't bring as much in anymore, but Tilted Shed out of California.
Yes, I've seen Tilted Shed as well. Yeah,
just if you want to do the entire state, and John at Black Duck Ciders. Black Duck is probably one of my favorite ciders in New York State, along with Aaron Burr.
Awesome. And Aaron Burr being sort of iconoclastic.
Yeah, he's the one person else. I highly recommend reading his book.
This is Andy Brennan.
Andy Brennan just wrote a new book through Chelsea Green Publishing.
Yep.
And he is the only person on this earth who I believe deserves to be on a high horse and is allowed to say whatever he wants because he's the one person I've seen that has never compromised anything.
All right.
He just does his thing. And how... It's a great read halfway through it.
Cool. Great. Well, thanks so much, Jeff Russell from Eden Ciders. If you want to learn more about cider and cheese, go out and grab that book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We also do, if anyone ever wants to do cider classes or anything like that, they can reach me directly.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have Jeff's contact information up on our show page. He goes around and does cider classes, cider and cheese pairings for all the greats in New York City, and maybe coming to a town near you if you are in Colorado or Japan sometime in the next few months. All right. This has been Cutting the Curd. I'm Aaron Foster, your host. It has been a delight, and I look forward to speaking to you soon over the airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.